Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a heralder of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining and analyzing a very interesting question. And that question is related to a subject connected to the general topic of Islamic government. And that question is this: what are the duties and rights of the imam and the community? You know, this at first glance, you know, this question might seem to be implying that we're talking about the infallible imam or the imam of the, you know, entire Muslim ummah. You know, we want to kind of generalize this question so that it includes not only, you know, that aspect, but also any kind of ruler in general, any kind of, you know, any kind of overseer of, you know, affairs. It could be like the imam of, you know, a jama'at. It could be the, you know, the leader of an Islamic community in some city or some village, right? Obviously, he's leading these people, you know, and, you know, Islam has prescribed certain duties for him, and reciprocally, he has certain rights. Same thing goes for the community or the people he is leading. So that's the question we want to ask today. Unfortunately, we have many hadiths and verses of the Holy Quran, which can serve as inspiration, and by means of which we can, you know, answer this question. In this connection, fortunately, we have many hadiths narrated from Imam Ali alayhi salam regarding this subject. Let's look at some of them, and in light of these, we can kind of analyze the answer to the question that we posed. In one hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam has been reported as having said, "It is the duty of an imam to rule in accordance with what Allah has revealed." So first of all, the first duty incumbent upon the leader is to rule and to regulate the affairs of his subjects in accordance with Allah's laws, right? So he shouldn't swerve from the laws that Allah has prescribed. So this is the first basic duty of the imam, right? Secondly, and that he delivers what he has been entrusted with. So this kind of, this could be taken in a general sense. So if he has been given some trust, let's say that he's been entrusted with a duty, right? He's been entrusted with, you know, I don't know, keeping the masjid tidy, keeping the center that he's, you know, running tidy. This is part of his duty. It's his duty to make sure that the funds that are being collected in the mosque are being utilized in a good way. Or, you know, he might have been entrusted with other duties as well. Whatever he's been entrusted with, he should deliver that which he has been entrusted with. Or, for example, if some funds have been given to him to hand it to be handed over to the respective religious authorities, he should deliver what he has been entrusted with. That if he does that, the imam says, then it is the duty of the people to listen to him. Right? This is one of the duties of the people, right? That they should listen to him. Right? Obviously, they have hired him as an expert, you know, in religious affairs, right? And just like any expert, when you go to an expert for advice, it's kind of contradictory to, on one hand, be going to the and referring to the person for advice, and on the other hand, not listening to the person and calling his expertise into question, right? So if we have assessed that this person is an expert, and, you know, and we have admitted to that, we should listen to him. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the reciprocal duties and rights between the imam and the community, in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Sayyid Zahir, the standard bearer of Ahlul Bayt.
Part 2.
Sayyid Zahir is so busy in the U.S. that it seems like he has been planning for these days for years. As if he was born here. As if he was destined to live this life. But he believes he has had no role in what has happened to him. He believes the honor of serving the Ahlul Bayt has only been a blessing from God. He is now the standard bearer of Ahlul Bayt and does his best to spread the rich Islamic culture. Pakistan is an extraordinary country. It is the land of the true supporters of Ahlul Bayt, and at the same time, the birthplace of their most spiteful enemies. As an example, the town of Kamalia, as Sayyid Zahir says himself, the most extremist leaders of the anti-Shia Takfiri groups were born in his hometown of Kamalia, or nearby areas. Interestingly enough, Sayyid Zahir's ancestors chose this city as their destination when they emigrated from India to Pakistan. His ancestors are known as Kamalia Sadat. Sadat, in Islamic tradition, refers to the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad. Arif al-Husseini had turned into a messiah for Shias in Pakistan, and meeting him was everybody's dream. A dream that came true for Sayyid Zahir, before Arif al-Husseini's martyrdom. Sayyid Zahir says he owes his life story to the greatness of Arif al-Husseini's presence. He had promised Sayyid Zahir to help him continue his studies in Qom if he gets all A's at the end of high school and goes to college for 4 years. Sayyid Zahir says he forgot all about the Al-Husseini's promise when he was martyred. He graduates from high school with A grades and is then admitted to college. He studies there for 2 years and then travels to Qom to continue his education there. He, however, cannot meet his friends who were going to help him with his plans. He therefore returns to Pakistan and studies law for 2 years. After finishing college, he gets ready to go to the U.S. at his father's insistence. Promoting the teachings of Ahlul Bayt through television had turned into Sayyid Zahir's main mission. He had to start from somewhere. He contacted his friends, but nobody agreed to help. His dream seemed to be impossible. Even the most sagacious of his friends believed it was impossible to have a television channel without government funding. But Sayyid Zahir could not sit still and do nothing. At At about the same time, another exodus happened in his life, and he left New York for California. Perhaps he had to go to California to be able to start his own television channel. There, he got the chance to pay TV channels for a few hours of airtime and talk to the people. Then he sold his house and launched his own television channel. It's extremely difficult to open a TV channel without a government funding and keep it running for a long time. And the audience knows it too. That is why people are not very interested in small and independent channels. But Syed Zahir wouldn't give up, even if it came at the price of selling his house and farmland. Velayat TV was about to go off air when one of his audience members called and asked Syed Zahir to organize a pilgrimage to Karbala. He turned the idea into reality. It was a successful experience followed by two more journeys in the very first year. Little by little, and thanks to the Karbala pilgrimage plans and supporters of Ahlul Bayt, the audience of his TV grew day by day, and Velayat TV survived a definite threat of fear. The plan to allow people to salute Imam Hussein alayhi salam live via a television program saved Syed Zahir's channel. He realized the significance of his program when he was invited to deliver a 10-minute speech in English to mark the birth anniversary of Imam Hussein at the holy shrine of the third Shia Imam. The program became so successful that the officials of Karbala TV gave Syed Zahir an extraordinary offer. He was allowed to continue his show at the channel, not for 10 minutes, but for 5 days a month. Syed Zahir immediately accepts without thinking of the hardship. Now it's been 4 years since Syed Zahir started commuting between California and Dubai every month. From there, he flies to Tehran, stays there for 1 day, then visits Hazrat Masume's shrine in Qom, from which he goes to Najaf and finally reaches Karbala. He returns all the way back home. These activities cover 10 days of his monthly schedule. From the large number of Syed Zahir's viewers, the Urdu-speaking people of the world are the most excited ones. In all these years, they haven't had the chance to express their feelings for Imam Hussein in their mother tongue and through a television channel. Syed Zahir had the honor of hosting such a show every month. But this was not the whole story. Syed Zahir's speeches during Muharram gathered Urdu-speaking Shias at the site of Imam Hussein's shrine so that they can perform their traditional mourning rituals in their mother tongue. Syed Zahir's life story is full of ups and downs. It is the story of someone who is guided by the paths in front of him to carry out his heavy responsibility and achieve his goals. Syed Zahir is thankful for all the honor that God has bestowed upon him. But at a closer look, one realizes that what happened to him in all these years is something more than professional success in preaching Islam. To become someone like Syed Zahir, it takes a very strong reason. The image that Syed Zahir's closest friends and family hold about him is that of a man with a suitcase who keeps going on long trips, a man whose eyes tell the story of his many sleepless nights. But a month later, he returns to Iran to go to Karbala again. No sign of exhaustion is found in his words. He's only anxious to make it on time to his live program on Vilayat TV, a program which should go on air in only 24 hours and after a lengthy 20-hour trip.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
In the modern times, we have this notion that's been understood of plurality. Now, plurality is not always a bad thing. It's a term that can be used in so many different ways. Some uses of it are very genuine and very appropriate. For example, we live in societies where people come from many different backgrounds, many different faith backgrounds, and we're in the same space, we're sharing the same space, we're living in the same society. And in that sense, for somebody to have a pluralistic outlook, I'm using these terms deliberately because we need to understand that sometimes they're used in different ways. For somebody to have a pluralistic outlook where they see themselves as a member of a diverse society is something which is positive. However, pluralism itself at times can be something which is exactly the opposite of ideology. Ideology is where we understand truth and we understand the application of truth because of there being an absolute standard. Sometimes pluralism can run contrary to that. And so in order to explain this, I want to give an example. Yesterday, I quoted to you the ayah of the Quran from Surah Luqman, where Allah describes himself as being al-haq, being the truth. Now, if you want to make a picture of this, imagine that we have somebody who is thirsty. And that somebody who's thirsty is searching for some water to drink. There are some who say that truth itself is relative. There is no absolute standard for truth. Anybody who thinks that they have access to the truth, they are like somebody who's thirsty. They think that there's a lake somewhere out there, and they think that there's a way to get to that lake. But in reality, what's out there is not a lake, it's a mirage. There is no such thing like a lake. The only thing we can tell you is that there are no lakes. All the lakes are mirages. That is the example of absolute relativity of truth. And that is a type of thought, if you go to the universities, if you go to humanities, right? It is, if you go to architecture, it's quite amazing. Sometimes you see structures being put up that reflect this type of thought pattern. Thoughts and ideologies can actually have a huge impact on the way a society is formed, including construction. I'll just make a side point here. Traditionally, the construction of Islamic centers and mosques was done in a way where it blended humbly into the surrounding environment. Even the roofs, if you go and study, they were made in a way that they wouldn't protrude boldly into the sky. They would fade in. Why? Because everything has a position in front of God, including the buildings that we build. But postmodern architecture is something which is completely different. You go and it's just, I don't know what word you say about it, maybe you say bizarre. Right? There's no rhyme or reason to why they do what they do. So this is one ideology relative to the relativity of truth. Now here, as I said, you might think that you have access to the truth, but whether you're a Jew or a Christian or a Buddhist or you have belief in a naturalist or a pagan religion, all of that is just a mirage. Right? You can go chasing it in your life if you want, but at the end of the day, you're going to realize that all your efforts were futile. Now you can imagine what the implications of this ideology are. And sometimes we see that, unfortunately, even among our youth. Which is that when I'm taught, when there's an entire education system that's predicated on this, then I end up starting to believe that everything, all efforts are absolutely futile. It's just I'm chasing a mirage. Well, what's the point of living then? Right? I don't have anything to work towards. Right? This is something which is quite dangerous. There's another level of pluralism which is called not the relativity of truth. It's called the relativity of knowledge. Now this is a little bit better, a little bit more acceptable to us, but not completely, because there's something that's also dangerous about this. Right? And of course, I'm working my way towards the Islamic understanding, and then I'm going to talk about the practical implications. The understanding of relativity of knowledge is what? That you think that you have access to the truth. You actually do have a right to say that there is truth out there. What you imagine to be truth is actually water. But in reality, there is no way for you to get to that water. So whether you're a Muslim or whether you are, again, Christian, Jew, whatever it is, right? There is an absolute truth out there. But that absolute truth is so great and so vast and so mysterious, no matter what you do, you're not going to be able to get there. It's not a mirage, but it's just a lake that you can't access. So what happens now? The net effect is that it's the same thing. Because all the efforts that you put in, it's going to be futile. Just don't try. All right? That, of course, is something which is not acceptable to the people of faith. What is the third level of pluralism? And this is very important. The third level is something which is called the relativity of understanding. Now, what is this analogy? This analogy is one where I believe that there is truth out there. That truth is like a water, like lake. There is a lake out there. You can access that lake. You can get there. You can reach there. You can reach there through the path of Islam, and you might be able to reach there through other paths as well. However, there's an important caveat. Once you get there, how much of that water you're going to be able to take depends on a few factors. Number one is how much thirst you have. Right? People who aren't thirsty, when they get to that water, they're not going to be able to take from it. Right? I'm thirsty, I'm full, I can't drink any more water. Secondly, is what is your container by which you're going to be able to take this water? How much are you going to be able to take? Because let's say you get to the water and you have a tiny water bottle. And that water bottle itself has a hole in it. Well, whatever you're going to be able to get in that water bottle, it's going to be very limited. It's not saying that you have no access to the truth. It's questioning you and saying that how are you going to be able to position yourself to be able to get to the most water possible? How can you position yourself so that you're as thirsty as possible? So then when you get to that water, you're going to have some relief. So do you see here, brothers and sisters, with this analogy, it can help us to understand what our position should be in the society that we're in. Some will say that just take a position of neutrality, right? Just take the position that, look at different strokes for different folks, right? Your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth, and that's the way things are going to be. We live in a post-truth world. Sometimes you hear this expression. There's no point in trying to find the truth anymore. It's too difficult. It's too hard. We can put those aside and we can say that we have a more sophisticated understanding. We know, all of us, those who are sincere, those who are sincere in their faith, they might have some way of accessing that truth. It's possible. They're making their way toward that lake. Sometimes they might go this way or that way, but eventually they might get there. But what can we do to equip them so that when they get there, they have the best tools to access it?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Assalamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We are still in the month of gloom, the month of trial and tribulation, the month of sadness. And hopefully, inshallah, we can benefit from these months in order for us to get closer to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam by using our tears as a vehicle to get closer to the Imam, and by doing so, obviously, getting closer to the Rasul, and by doing so, then getting closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Muharram is just that. Muharram is not a time for us just to come and socialize in the gatherings and to, you know, just have tea and to, no. The tears and the drinking of tea all must be with an objective in mind. That objective is that we use this month that has been given to us as a gift by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to see one of His greatest creations slaughtered in such a manner so that the rest of creation can come closer to Him via this particular individual is a divine gift and a divine blessing. Unfortunately, it is us who are inattentive. It is us who are unaware. It is us who do not take advantage. For we see it in the wrong way. We see it as just a ceremony, we see it's just a habit, as a cultural thing. No, it is a reality. The tears that we shed are a reality. The grief that we feel is a reality. The pain in our chest is a reality. A reality that should and must take us somewhere. If not, we have not understood Ashura. We have not understood the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Anyway, one of the books that we would like to hopefully introduce to our dear brothers and sisters regarding Imam al-Hussein. Again, most of the books that have been written on Imam al-Hussein do not look at Ashura in what I have mentioned, but it looks at it in a very historical manner. What happened in this particular point, what happened in that particular point. This is important, this is very important. But obviously the higher levels of Ashura and Muharram also need to be looked at. Inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be looking, or rather we'll be introducing this book to our dear listeners. So please stay tuned. Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled Misbah al-Zulam, Roots of the Karbala Tragedy. The book was written by Sayyid Imdad Imam and translated by Sayyid Athar Hussein Rizvi. The book was then published by Ansarian Publications in the holy city of Qom, based in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, what is unfortunate is that this book, as mentioned in the first page of the book, was an English translation from the Urdu translation. So definitely, first of all, there was meaning lost in the first translation, and then even more meaning lost in the second translation. But anyway, it is a book, you know, that is there for us to kind of use and to increase our knowledge in whatever way possible. All books, especially when it comes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, are beneficial, inshallah. And the knowledge that we gain is not from the book, but via Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So anyway, this book was first published in the year 2009 and translated by Sayyid Athar Hussein H.S. Rizvi. He was translated many books. Unfortunately, some of the books that he has translated were not translated or edited very well. So a disclaimer to my dear listeners. So the books that this translator has done to kind of, you know, if you can read the original, alhamdulillah. If not, then, you know, be careful of what you read and always consult with somebody who is more learned or can read the original text in order for you to get a better understanding and a true understanding of what the author is saying. So again, the book, which is titled Misbah al-Zulam fi Masa'ib al-Karbala, was probably most likely written in Arabic, then translated to Urdu, and then translated to English. As we can obviously see, there could have been a lot of meaning lost in translation. So again, the book, for example, deals with the history behind the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Fadak during the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and then obviously going towards Karbala, but obviously looking at Fadak and Saqifah as the main points of where the roots of Karbala occurred. So again, it is an historical discussion. It's not something that, you know, it is based on belief. It's a historical discussion. But again, the story is a very important aspect of our knowledge of the world around us, and so on and so forth. And again, it goes through answering certain questions regarding, you know, cultural things and other things. Some of the book, you know, may not be beneficial. Like, for example, Lovers of Muawiyah today, for example, is not something that, you know, more benefit, especially in the current light of affairs in the Muslim Ummah. But anyway, let's see, inshallah. Again, a disclaimer of reading this book. Please read it carefully and obviously consult those who are more learned. So inshallah, for the benefit of our dear listeners, we will be reading a section of this book for the benefit of them, inshallah. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. With me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners today was titled Misbah al-Zulam, and it was written by Sayyid Imdad Imam and translated into English by Sayyid Athar Hussein Rizvi. It was published in Qum by Ansarian Publications. Like I said, it's a very polemical book. But anyway, inshallah, it'll be beneficial in some way. All books, inshallah, if we seek intent, the right guide, can be beneficial, inshallah. So the book on page 326 speaks about the excellence of Shias. We should know that Shias, this is where we see the translation being weak. We know, or rather we should know that Shia sect is a group that obeys and follows the path of His Eminence Ali alayhi salam, and is convinced of the imamate of His Eminence Ali alayhi salam and his sons. The sect believes in the imamate of Ali alayhi salam as based on religious texts, Nas, whether it may be hidden or public. This sect believes that the imamate of His Eminence Ali alayhi salam or of his sons cannot go to others, whether by oppression of unjust or through dissimulation. Initially, all the Shias followed the practice of their imams, but after a passage of a long period of time, there appeared many subsects. The writer says, the progeny of His Eminence Ali alayhi salam continued on the practice of the infallible imams of their family for a long time, and then dissension arose among them and they divided into various groups. They also became susceptible to the influence of Sunni rule, and many Shia sects became Sunnis, as still seen in the Indian state of Bihar today, where a large number of Sunni Sayyids are found, who, due to ignorance, think that their grandfather was Ali alayhi salam, and the religion of the successors of Ali alayhi salam was same as theirs. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the ability to truly understand the wilayah of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and to not to make it a polemical thing, inshallah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Midstream.
Official told Reuters last week that the Secretary of State Anthony Blinken signed on Tuesday, June 18, a new exemption related to national security that allows Iraq to pay the cost of electricity to Iran and allows for the first time to deposit payments in non-Iraqi bank accounts. Yes, you heard that right. The U.S., which denies having any influence in politics and economic and financial affairs for Iraq, has officially allowed Iraq, a sovereign state, to pay off energy debt to another sovereign state, being the Islamic Republic of Iran. The official, who spoke on condition that his name and position not be disclosed, added that the United States hopes that the 100-day waiver will help ease Iranian pressures on Iraq to obtain funds that previously could only be deposited in restricted accounts inside Iraq. Iraq has now been granted green light by the U.S. authorities to pay about $2.76 billion of its gas and electricity debt to Iran after receiving this U.S. sanctions waiver. The Iraqi government was deeply embarrassed by its inability to fulfill its promise to secure electric power during the months of July and August, which are the hottest months of the year in the country, which prompted popular and political circles to blame it for the continuation of this crisis. However, the coordinating framework supporting the Iraqi government held Washington responsible for the return of the electricity crisis due to its refusal to allow Baghdad to pay for Iranian gas. The agreement signed between Iraq and Iran on July 11th of this year came to exchange Iranian gas for Iraqi oil as a way to avoid U.S. sanctions to open the way for resolving one part of this crisis. Iran had reduced its gas exports to Iraq by more than 50% as of the 1st of July after Baghdad was unable to obtain the approval of the United States of America to disperse the money owed to Iran. Iraq imports electricity and gas from Iran, which together make up between 33% and 40% of its energy supplies, especially in the scorching summer months when temperatures reach 50 degrees Celsius and energy consumption peaks. Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani had previously announced that Iraq owes Iran about 11 billion euros, but is having difficulty repaying these debts due to U.S. sanctions that only allow Tehran to obtain funds to purchase non-sanctioned goods, such as food and medicine. Meanwhile, the Parliamentary Electricity and Energy Committee called on the Iraqi government to put pressure on the United States of America to remove the energy file from political calculations, while the coordinating framework called on Washington to release dues for Iranian gas imports in order to avoid the negative repercussions of the crisis on the Iraqi citizen. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken signed a new national security waiver allowing Iraq to pay Iran for electricity by depositing payments into non-Iraqi bank accounts. The U.S. exemption extends to 120 days, claiming that non-Iraqi banks will need to obtain U.S. permission to disperse funds that will be directed only for humanitarian purposes. Under U.S. punitive measures, Iraq's payments for Iranian electricity can only be dispersed from accounts registered inside Iraq and with U.S. permission, supposedly for Iran to purchase its humanitarian needs. To discuss this issue with us from Baghdad is Dr. Safwan Qusay, professor of economics at the University of Baghdad and expert in Iraqi economics. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Safwan. Now, due to decades of conflicts and sanctions, Iraq is dependent on imports from Iran for a lot of its gas needs. However, we have seen that U.S. sanctions on the Iranian oil and gas industry have hampered Iraq's payments for its imports, putting it in a very heavy debt for its neighbor. Yet, in mid-June, Iraq got a U.S. approval to clear $2.76 billion U.S. dollars gas debt to Iran. Now, if Iraq had paid in due time, it wouldn't have accumulated that much money to be paid in a lump sum at one period of time. How is Iraq expected to survive financially with such blatant U.S. sanctions?
It is clear that Iraq definitely needs electricity and gas, especially in the summer. However, the process of financial regulation between Iraq and the payment of these dues requires a financial agreement under the supervision of the U.S. Treasury in order for there to be a flow of financial transfers either directly or through the restricted account in favor of the purchase of humanitarian and non-human goods in Iran. Practically, the Iraqi delay in approving the budget for the year 2023 contributed to the difficulty of paying these dues at the appropriate times. Nevertheless, currently the joint account within the Trade Bank of Iraq contains sufficient funds to pay these dues. Of course, the United States of America needs permission from the U.S. Treasury in order for these dues to be paid. However, it seems that they have credited these amounts to a non-national bank so that the payment through this account will be for Iran's needs and under the supervision of the United States of America.
Well, according to media reports, we did see that both Tehran and Baghdad have found several solutions to receive the Iranian money from the Central Bank of Iraq itself, which is basically not allowed by the U.S. But Iraq's outstanding payments to Iran will be cleared gradually as per this new agreement within the next 3 to 5 or 6 months. But the U.S. waiver for Iraq is only for 120 days. Will Iraq be able to make this payment within this short period of time if it is not allowed to make it from within its own banks?
Of course, Iraq owns bank accounts and has sufficient funds to pay dues within letters of credit. But the problem is with the U.S. sanctions. If the Iraqi Central Bank Administration succeeded in setting up a financial mechanism to be an alternative to the direct transfer process, as Europe does, then certainly this agreement could contribute to transferring funds within a period of 120 days or less. Because this account could be placed within the Europeans' agreement with Iran, and there would be funds that Iran could make use of in importing at the level of European companies. The request of Iraq to join this European, basically German, French, and even British trade agreement with the Iranians could contribute to the transfer of funds and thus become at the disposal of the Iranian side in purchasing items that the Iranian people deserve through this account.
Do you think that the U.S. will allow such an inclusion of Iraq in this agreement?
In my opinion, we have to turn illegal trade into legal trade. The volume of trade exchange now between Iraq and Iran is more than $10 billion annually. Certainly, all operations carried out by Iraqi banks, directly or indirectly, or purchasing dollars from the parallel market are supposed to be under a clear system of circulation. I think such a request is supposed to be met with justice from the American side. Just as the Europeans were allowed to proceed with this agreement, the Iraqis and Emiratis can also be included under this umbrella in order to remove sanctions from Iraqi banks or Emirati companies, for example. The Americans claim that they are not against the interests of the Iranian people, and this agreement can be used for the benefit of the Iranian people. Thus, we will create a sustainable trade mechanism away from U.S. sanctions.
Well, I want to discuss with you the internal Iraqi crisis of energy. It baffles me really that a resourceful country like Iraq is yet to build its own power plant, despite the U.S. promise to do so after it destroyed the infrastructure of the country after the aftermath of the 2003 invasion. I mean, maybe a nuclear power plant would cost Iraq slightly more than its current debt for Iran. That's one nuclear power plant, and would solve the entire problem, or at least maybe 80% of that problem. What stops Iraq from pursuing this, doing this kind of solution for the Iraqi people?
The electric power sector was destroyed in 1991 and rehabilitated after 2003 with the increase in energy demand and population growth. Yes, there were efforts by previous governments and also the current government to conclude contracts at the level of investment in establishing new stations, investing in solar energy, electric power, and investing in associated gas to generate electricity by relying on Iraqi gas. Projects already exist with the solid companies like that of General Electric, Siemens, or Francis Total, but this issue takes time. In my opinion, energy security in Iraq is monitored by the government, and we are trying to meet local demand through Iraqi stations. The issue of purchasing a nuclear power plant, in my opinion, yes, is an option. The National Investment Commission is now able, with its money and vision, to buy ready-made stations, whether in Turkey, the Kingdom of Jordan, or even Egypt, where the production of these stations be in the service of Iraq. Currently, Iraq is seeking to link to the Persian Gulf and to be a transit point for energy between the Gulf and the European Union. We are witnessing governmental efforts in this direction, and we will have stability in energy. But the matter takes time, so we are currently in dire urgency to continue importing energy from the Iranian side, whether electricity or gas, until we have the capability to rely on Iraqi resources.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Safwan Qusay, professor of economics at the University of Baghdad and expert in Iraqi economics, for joining us to discuss this new matter of giving birth for the Iraqi government to pay its debt for the Iranian government. I want to thank you very much for joining us. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the U.S. sanctioning 14 Iraqi banks.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The United States imposed sanctions on 14 Iraqi banks, according to an American Wall Street Journal report last week, quoting U.S. officials explaining that the punitive measures prevent these banks from conducting transactions in dollars as part of a comprehensive campaign to transfer U.S. dollars to Iran. This is not the first time that the U.S. Treasury Department has imposed sanctions and restrictions on Iraqi banks as part of an attempt to surround and curb financial flows from banks in Iraq to the Islamic Republic of Iran. More details in the following report.
The United States of America imposed sanctions on 14 Iraqi banks, claiming that these new punitive measures prevent the Iraqi banks from conducting transactions in U.S. dollars as part of a comprehensive campaign to transfer the U.S. dollar to the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is not the first time that the U.S. Treasury Department imposes sanctions and restrictions on Iraqi banks as part of an attempt to surround and curb financial flows from banks in Iraq to Iran as part of the trade relations between the two countries. Tehran had previously accused Washington of conspiring against Iraq and held it responsible for the crisis of the collapse of the Iraqi dinar last year in return for the high exchange rate of the dollar inside Iraq, a crisis that triggered a wave of protests. Meanwhile, the sudden rise in the exchange rate of the U.S. dollar against the Iraqi dinar, which resulted mainly from restrictions imposed by the U.S. Federal Reserve in New York, had immediate economic effects in the form of a decline in business activity, a rise in the prices of imported goods, and an exacerbation of social tensions. At the heart of this crisis lies the problem of the U.S. obsession with controlling any trade Iraq conducts, especially with neighboring countries like the Islamic Republic of Iran, which the U.S. deems illegal from its own unilateral point of view. The repercussions and consequences of this financial crisis, which is the most serious since 2003, are not limited to the economic situation only, but also have geostrategic repercussions and will have a significant impact on the political power relations in Iraq. In November 2022, the Federal Reserve in New York began restricting the amount of dollars transferred to Iraq in compliance with a policy set years ago by the U.S. Treasury. In early 2020, the U.S. Treasury Department required the Iraqi government to comply with an electronic system that U.S. officials claim is intended to ensure transparency in dollar transactions, combat money laundering, and smuggle dollars into Iran, Syria, and Turkey, also known as normal trade ties with Iraqi bordering countries. As a result of these restrictions, approximately 80% of requests for dollar remittances in Iraq were rejected. As a result, the value of the dinar in the foreign exchange market declined at the end of January 2023, as the price of $1 reached 1,750 dinars, compared to an official exchange rate of 1,460 dinars. The strict U.S. monetary policy towards the Iraqi state represented an incentive for the Iraqi authorities to adopt financial and economic policies that bypasses these illogical U.S. policies and evade U.S. sanctions to avoid the negative repercussions of the crisis on the regular Iraqi citizens. On the other hand, the strict U.S. monetary policy will have a significant impact on small and medium-sized companies and enterprises, which are accustomed to using the Hawala system, which is an informal transfer system that enables these companies to avoid going through both private and public banks.
Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. John Andrews, author, journalist, and broadcaster specializing in world politics. He is a contributing editor for The Economist and is a head tutor for Economist Education. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Andrews. It's a pleasure to have you. Now, the United States has barred 14 Iraqi banks from conducting dollar transactions. This is what the Wall Street Journal reported last week, citing U.S. officials for that matter. Now, the ban, which was imposed by the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, is part of some sort of a crackdown on the alleged siphoning of U.S. Currency to the Islamic Republic of Iran. That came less than a month after Iraq got a U.S. approval to clear $2.7 billion in debt and gas debt to be paid to the Islamic Republic of Iran within 120 days. So how is Iraq supposedly going to pay its debt if the U.S. less than a month later is banning Iraqi banks from conducting dollar transactions with the Islamic Republic of Iran?
That's a very good question, and there is no easy answer. I think the reality, the fact is that both Iraq and the United States and, in a sense, Iran are all trapped by what happened 20 years ago with the toppling of Saddam Hussein. I mean, the irony is that, you know, Iraq could easily pay its own way because it's got all its oil revenue. But that oil revenue, thanks to a UN Security Council resolution back in, I guess, 2003, after the toppling of Saddam, is lodged in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And that means that Iraq has to withdraw it from New York each time it needs foreign hard currency. And the problem, of course, is that Iran is subject to American sanctions, very, very tough American sanctions. So is Iran's other neighbor, Syria. And you could argue that this is a kind of it's an impediment to normal trade. But you can see where the Americans are coming from. They have sanctioned Iran in particular ever since 1979, mm-hmm. and the toppling of the Shah. And they also have they are sanctioning Syria because of Bashar al-Assad's reaction to, you know, what was called, rather misleadingly, the Arab Spring. And so you have this kind of odd situation in which America is trying to reinforce its sanctions, trying to implement them properly, and is coming across the reality that when you have sanctions, someone is always going to be clever enough to evade those sanctions. Mm-hmm. Added to that, of course, is you have rampant corruption in Iraq. And that explains, I think, one of the problems that the Iraqi government has to deal with as well. It's, and you know very well that some Iraqi officials were involved in all the money laundering that went on. So you can see it from both sides' point of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, Iraq, by virtue of its strategic location, it finds itself stuck in a difficult situation between two rivals. We have the United States of America on one side, the Islamic Republic of Iran on the other, as it cannot satisfy its natural relations and ties with its bordering neighboring country, Iran, at the expense of more U.S. Sanctions that might come in the future. Yet Iraq depends heavily on Iran for both electricity and gas, or else it wouldn't survive. What options do you think Iraq can maneuver with in such a situation?
I think it's very, very difficult for Iraq. And I mean, you know, as I said before, there is no easy solution. If there were, it would have been taken already. The problem is that Iraq is not going to become a clean, uncorrupt country overnight. Obviously not. I mean, this is just an endemic problem in a huge part of the world, and I'm not excluding Europe from this, nor the United States. But you can see that from America's point of view, it needs to put pressure on Iran, not least in terms of renegotiating the Iran nuclear deal, the deal that Barack Obama and the EU and China and Russia and Germany did with Iran, but which of course was torn up effectively by Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, to put pressure on Iran, it means enforcing the sanctions more and more effectively. That, of course, means that Iraq becomes between, the metaphor is always between a rock and a hard place. Mm-hmm. And you can see Iraq's plight in this. I don't really think that it can do much except to appeal to the better nature of the American administration. Now, does
if,
that
if
better,
they ever have one?
But exactly, I mean, does that better nature exist? I think the only positive thing from an Iraqi point of view is that somehow I think that the American administration, regardless of whether it's Democrat or Republican, has to show that the topping of Saddam Hussein and the invasion of Iraq had gains as well as losses, that Iraq is actually an improving country. And in many ways, of course, it is, with democratic elections and so on. Now,